I left out one important detail. Since this, for the most part, is a sandwich of three different metals, the ratio proportion of the mass existing between each metallic type will determine the predominant quality that takes place. In other words, if copper mass should be increased relative to the aluminum and the magnetizable iron, since the copper represents the active, according to Dort Jr., quote cited by William Lyne in Pentagon Aliens, and since what he when he says active, how we take that to mean nowadays would be the reactive or the reactants. So that means you get more power, because that's where the power is coming from, is the reactants. Now, the aluminum has to do with levitation, or the cancellation of inertia, if you prefer. So if the aluminum should be in excess, then that should be the noticeable quality. Whereas if the iron predominates, then you get a usefulness. That's where you get the usefulness. You know, the reactants is not useful, right? But without having to do anything complicated to convert the reactants into real power, you use iron to do it. And if the iron should predominate, then you get a good deal of conversion. So now, mass would be one way to look at it, but there might be another way to look at it, is the square area, and then versus the thickness of each metallic plate or film, if you prefer, because, you know, you could go very thin with a leaf product, you know, like what they hammer out, you know, gold leaf, silver leaf. Well, this would be copper leaf, aluminum leaf, versus plates that are substantially thicker. And then you've got your idea of capacitance, in which if one plate differs in size from another plate, and each plate is separated by a dielectric, let's say saran wrap, now you've got power considerations. And Thomas Bearden talked about this. You know, what happens when you design a capacitor in which the plate on one side is a different square area than the plate on the other side? In fact, the Amon brothers made use of a copper sphere, and if the copper sphere was hollow, that means the inner surface is a different square area than the outer surface due to their separation. They have a different radius. Let's see, what else? It's the utter simplicity of design. So now I'll get into details. I was a little hesitant yesterday. Well, so we've got saran wrap in between each metallic layer, and aluminum is in the center, surrounded by copper on either side, and then iron on either side of that, and a dielectric such as saran wrap in between each, and on the outer as well, so that you don't get any sparking or shorting between the plates. So they're not electrically connected. They're magnetically coupled, and that's as far as it goes. But they are also capacitively coupled because of the dielectric in between them. So it's kind of like creating a laminate structure for an armature of a motor. In fact, I wonder what would happen if we started to build our motor armatures using a laminate structure that's not all iron, but alternating layers, such as I've described. Do we get a greater power gain? Do we get any power gain? And if so, how much? Based on the recipe of how much mass or how much square area of each plate that we're dealing with. Now, there has to be, let's see, what else? What was the other qualifier? Now, what I envision is that since everything is based on magnetic coupling in order to accomplish throughput, so it's not just, you know, a static situation of capacitance. what I imagine is the case is that, let's say if you have a power cord that you want to run through it and it comes out to two ports on the outside of the project box, then the power cord probably is wrapped twice around, you know, if these are plates creating like a notebook-shaped rectangular box or shape, then the power cord, it could be shaped in the round, I suppose, but it doesn't really matter. The power cord would go around the perimeter. It would be like the primary of a Tesla coil, I think, is the proper term. And I think the minimum is two turns, if I'm not mistaken. That was the case in a electromechanical watt-hour meter from 1910. The current coil was two turns. I think it was 700 turns on the voltage coil, if I'm not mistaken. and the current coil was very thick, and it was solid core. I remember that. Very stout, you know, low gauge number on the current coil, and on the voltage coil, it was a much higher gauge number, much thinner wire, and the insulation on the voltage coil was different. I think it was enameled, while the insulation on the current coil was a cloth weave. So this goes around, and that should pick up the power that comes off of it, but the power will be largely determined by the iron and the copper. But if we want it to levitate, now what we do is we extend the aluminum plate out into the vessel itself so that we have this humongous amount of aluminum mass and surface area that comprises the aluminum layer, or at least one of them, because it doubles as the vessel carrying the passengers. And the reason why I say this is because I got curious. I had this hunch that maybe... See, I assumed... The story goes that Nikola Tesla tested out his theory by creating a proof of concept making use of a potbelly stove that was large enough for him to get into. And I thought to myself, well, gee, that must be a pretty big potbelly stove. But then, after some time had passed, I started getting the hunch, no, wait a minute, maybe it's not cast iron. Maybe it's aluminum. And I looked up and I found advertisements dating back to about 100 years ago. So it wouldn't be in the era that Tesla built the thing. It would have been a few decades after that. But still close enough, I figured, you know, I assumed. I found advertisements for potbelly stoves that were large, probably large enough to fit a man in, a man could fit into if he, you know, curled up into a little ball. And Tesla was not a short person. He was not a Steinmetz physiology. But be that as it may, I did manage to find aluminum potbelly stoves big enough for probably Tesla to get into. So if the... and then maybe the sequencing changes. Instead of having iron on the outermost two plates, sandwiching this sandwich of five layers of these three conductive metals, maybe the aluminum goes on the outside, and then all you have to do is build up your sandwich, let's say on the floor or the ceiling or on top of the roof of the potbelly stove, you know, keep the passenger on the inside away from the device, but one of the plates is the bottommost plate that would be the shell of the craft, the aluminum vessel. Then it becomes very easy. You just stack them on there. Probably weld them, I suppose. Now I'm assuming dielectric separation between them. Now that's for power. If you're going for levitation, maybe you don't need that. Maybe you do need them to be segregated, you know, not a mixed up alloy. But maybe you don't have to have dielectric in between them. But if you do have to have a dielectric layer in between them, what would you use? Would you use glass? I mean, glass is my favorite. I think Tesla used mica. So mica's thin. You know, you could use mica, I suppose. Sorry. Let's see what else. And there's one finishing touch. Well, two finishing touches. Originally, I was thinking that the project box would serve as a mold so that you put the circuit in there. So all these layered stacks of saran wrap and sheet metal or leaf, metallic leaf, whatever you're using. And then you've got your power cord wrapped around it a couple times. Or it might be just a copper band once around. And then, you know, split at one point so it's not a complete circle. So you can have your two leads come in to be your two terminals. Because that's what you use on the primary on a Tesla coil are copper bands in some cases anyway, some designs. So let's see, what was I getting at? So you've got all that in the project box, but the project box is lined with aluminum. Probably something thin, like aluminum leaf or aluminum foil. Now, aluminum foil actually is a layer of electroplated aluminum on top of wax paper. I found this out the hard way when I was using it to cook. I usually don't cook with the stuff. I put it in the oven covering a dish, and I guess I had potatoes I was roasting, and it literally melted. The aluminum foil melted holes in it, and I thought, oh my God, am I eating aluminum? Where did it go to? No, it just, I hope not, but it definitely melted. I found out, and then I looked it up, and I found out that's how they make it. But in any case, regardless, so the aluminum is lining the inside surface area of the project box. Now, if you pour a dielectric, let's say melted wax, into that, or epoxy resin or something similar, into the project box to seal everything up and create one massive dielectric block, even though you have, you know, multiple layers of metallic sheet or leaf, that helps to soak up the electrostatic charge that's inevitably going to be coming out of this device. And you want to do that because you don't want it to leak out into the environment because you're wasting it. You want to use it. Unless, of course, you're doing a UFO craft, in which, now that I think of it, you probably would have a minimum or maybe no dielectric because you don't want it to be targeted, shall we say, to a dielectric material. You want it to be exported out of the vessel in order to electrically charge the space surrounding it so that you'll have a holding vessel, so to speak, made of electrostatic charge that will hold the magnetism in place outside the vehicle. So I guess if you're doing this as a power generator, you'd want to use a dielectric because you don't want to get in trouble with the FCC and you don't want to waste electrostatic charge. You want to keep it inside the device. But for a UFO, you want it to come out, and I imagine, let's put it this way, I like to imagine that all UFOs, which are made by man, of course, are registered, just like you go and register a motor vehicle. And and the satellites probably keep track of all of them flying around. And I would imagine further that the way how they track it, they probably have their own little signature beep, shall we say, a calling card that they emit so that you can tell one craft from another, look it up on the roster list, and oh yeah, it's okay. Anything else, we shoot it down, you know, because it's not registered. You know, talk about strict policing. But I would imagine that's the way it works, because how else would you regulate air traffic and keep track of who's who and who belongs to who? You can't get up close to look at the license plate when it's traveling 4,000 miles an hour and can turn on a dime. And we know about William Lyon has spoken of, or somebody has spoken of, these geodesic markers are strewn across the planet, and that helps these craft triangulate their location on the planet, above the surface of the planet when they're traveling around. Let's see. So, oh, probably because they ground out the electrostatic field, but in such a mild way that it's not severe like it was with William Reich. So it doesn't cause the craft to fall out of the sky. But it just enough, it's like a little dot, a little dimple in the fabric of electrostatic field surrounding the Earth. And they can probably sense those dimples in the energy field, in the electrostatic field, so that they can tell where they are. And maybe it has to do with the mass of the geodesic marker, or the geometry, or the size that tells them apart one from the next. Let's see. So it's good talking this out loud, because I realize now that dielectric material really has little or no place in the UFO version versus the power generator version. Let's see what else. So the aluminum foil on the inside of the project box, I guess this would be the power generator version, is intended to throw the energy back into the device. We don't want any of it to leak out, and yet we want the dielectric material to store it, store the excess charge that's coming out of these plates. Let's see what else. Yeah, I think that's all I had to say, but there was one little side note that's kind of interesting. When William Lyon got me turned on to this back in 2014, I decided that the only way I was going to start to learn about this, although I didn't know it as the trimetal generator at the time, maybe, I just knew it was an offshoot of the electromechanical water meter, because that's what William Lyon kept pushing, the idea that that's our model to work from, that's all we know, it's some variation of that, or implementation of that. Because it has all three metals. It's got the aluminum perforated disc on the inside, it's got copper windings, and it's got a lot of iron. Let's see. What was the other thing? Oh, so I started constructing an earthing device, an earthing enhancement device, to help me get in touch with the iron principle, because I thought the iron was the most important principle to try to figure out and learn about it. But eventually, I included aluminum. So what I did was I got these floor flanges that are made out of cast iron. I never did test them to see if they were magnetizable. I don't know if cast iron is magnetizable or not. I would imagine it is, because it's a pretty simple recipe. It's just you know, a certain amount of carbon. It's carbon steel, isn't it? So I got these floor flanges of various sizes, and I would wrap, I think it was 18 gauge heavily insulated copper wire around it. By comparison to a magnetic winding wire, you know, this was very thick insulation. So I wound it around that one layer. And I would, one floor flange, it would be wound clockwise, and the other counterclockwise, and I'd sandwich them together, because the the base of a floor flange, the one that goes against the floor or the wall, as the case may be, so that, you know, it's mostly a flat surface. Yeah, well, that's the only flat surface, is on one side. And so I had them matching. But then I thought to myself, why don't I surround this with Saran wrap, and then aluminum foil, and then Saran wrap. And I had a certain way I connected it. I had, so the coils were self-looped. You know, the coil looped back to itself. So it was one continuous loop of copper wire. And then I took off the insulation at two locations on opposite sides of the winding to connect two leads which went out from the device. One went to my earthing bed sheet, and the other went to an earthing rod in a very tall conifer, 100-foot tall conifer or something. It was massive. That served as my grounding rod. And it was a very good choice, I must say. What I found was the thing was like worse than coffee. I mean, like 2 minutes, I lay down, you know, naked on the in the bed sheet to go to sleep. Within like 2 or 3 minutes, I bolted out of that bed so fast because I had so much stimulation, energetic stimulation. I had to work it off. It took me hours to work that off. You know, I got in front of the computer. I tried everything I could do, but I was wide awake. Whatever fatigue and exhaustion I felt or sleepiness was gone within a couple of minutes, and I had a problem on my hands. That's not what I wanted. I wanted to induce sleep, encourage sleep, enhance the sleeping experience. So I realized what I had to do was I had to separate the aluminum foil from the coil with a greater expanse of dielectric mass. So I chose to use quartz sand to create that separation, and then I just used a sewer pipe. I changed my configuration of how I built the next model. I used a galvanized pipe rather than floor flanges, so I didn't get the nice toroidal self-looping magnetic circuit, unfortunately, which would be the maximum of efficiency. But because I used a galvanized iron pipe, was it galvanized? Well, it was an iron pipe. And then I had to fill it with magnetite sand to make sure I made use of every empty space. But it was surrounded by quartz sand, so I put it in a sewer, a PVC sewage pipe. But I first lined the pipe with aluminum foil. So I knew intuitively, you know, I did it by trial and error. You know, every day I would assess how the sleep went and assess what impact it had on my physiology, on my consciousness. And I was able to intuit, feel my way through making changes to the circuit. But I can see now that I've come full circle. This is literally what I did. And I may have said this already in the prior recording, but it amazes me that what I started to do and ended up doing is what I'm now repeating all over again. Only now I'm looking at it from a different perspective of what purpose I'm going to use it for. Now, I would imagine that you have to start it off. You have to create a voltage difference between the outer, you know, outermost layer of a sheet of conductive metal on, let's say, the top side versus the bottom side. But you don't need a lot, depending on how you configure it. Like if you put in a lot of copper and iron, then it'll have a lot of power gain, and maybe just reserve thin leaf for the aluminum, you know, sandwich in between them, as well as lining the interior of the project case. Where was I? Oh. So you have to get it started, because obviously it's just not going to do anything on its own. So you have to create a voltage difference. So one way possibly to do it, the easy way I would imagine, is to solder a grounding wire to the outermost plate before it's covered with a Saran wrap, let's say. And that should create a voltage difference between the two opposite extreme sides of this device, so that you get a charge started, and it's low enough that it won't get in the way, because it'll be constant, unless you have a snap switch and disconnect it from ground, I suppose. But maybe it needs it. See, that's the other thing. I can't. There's no way that I can know just by doing simulations. Which way does it have to be done? Do you have to create, or do you have to feed it continuous power, or do you just give it an instant of voltage and then let it take off on its own? This I don't know. Obviously, there's no way for me to know. But it does have to be low enough that it steps out of the way of the reactants taking place inside of the copper that's going to want to escalate. So when the Amon brothers said it's scalable, you know, you can create any amount of power you want to, you just have to scale it upward, you know, scale it. What do you scale? Do you scale the mass, or the proportionality, you know, of mass or of surface area or of shape? Well, yeah, surface area would be shape. Or the layering, you know, how do you arrange your layers? So there's still a lot of plenty of wiggle room to get different results. And I'm also beginning to wonder if Marvin Cole inadvertently created this situation, and that's why he got levitation out of his device and freaked him out, and he gave up right then and there pursuing it any further. It may just come down to the same basic feature that, you know, there's no other efficient way to do it, or maybe no other way to do it. Now, how you get sideways motion across, I mean, it's one thing to appreciate how a device of this type could, when it's in levitational mode, how it can interact with the Earth, creating gravity, creating levity, and creating a buoyancy point at which the shell of the Earth floats. It's easy to imagine because the device is working off the Earth. The Earth is the machine. It's not a hunk of rock. It's a machine with consciousness, but it's a machine creating gravity and levity at the same time. And just like, you know, electricity is made up of two forces, the electromotive and the magnetomotive, gravity is no different. It's made up of two forces that are there in a certain type of balance of how much of one dominates over the other. But how do you get sideways motion? Well, now that I think of it, the Van Allen radiation belt is made up of a flow that I think it comes out of the North Pole and goes around and goes back into the South Pole, the magnetic flux flow. So with that kind of idea in mind, plus you're getting the spin of the Earth that's creating all kinds of Coriolis swirls, there's probably all kinds of rivers of flows that one can utilize to push against or pull, as the case may be, whatever is going on with these craft, to be able to do lateral movement. But what you do out in space is, I don't know, maybe you target various planets or stars as your references to move around in three-dimensional space. But on close to the surface of a planet, it's two-dimensional, and so it becomes a little... It's kind of the same, really. It's just in close proximity, you've got different forces that are arranged differently of different intensity because you're near the surface of a planet. Let's see. I think I've covered everything I wanted to say. So, you know, I'm just thinking about it, and, you know, how would I do it? And I go to the hardware store and I look at magnetizable hinges. I take a little magnet along, you know, and then I'm looking up online, etching copper sheet, etching copper for etching purposes. Your artists want to do some etching artwork with copper sheet. And then, of course, there's aluminum sheet. and then there's aluminum leaf and copper leaf. It's just the iron, the magnetizable iron, doesn't come in a leaf form. I haven't been able to find it or see it anywhere. Let's see what else. And it may not, obviously, a door hinge may not be the most magnetizable piece of iron sheet that is out there. Because I did find some variations among the larger iron sheets at Home Depot that was kind of intriguing. You know, I was just trying to look for, you know, what's available, just, you know, just proof of concept, just first timer. It was just first time trying to put this thing together. And I also feared, because I don't know what'll happen, will these plates want to separate? Will they create a desire not to be close together? Which means you'd have to put them in a vise situation to hold them together and to keep, you know, and keep them also in close proximity as well. You don't want them to separate and create gaps, and because then you'd lose your power. Let's see. So there are all these questions, but it's so straightforward and so simple. It makes me question, am I kidding myself? Am I creating a fantasy, that, you know, a self-fulfilling fantasy, because that's all it is a fantasy? Or is my simulator-trained brain actually simulating correctly what will happen and how to do it? I don't know. I've yet to find out. I don't have a big budget. In fact, I'm on poverty row at the moment, but figure if I keep it small, I'll be able to keep it economically manageable. You know, trying to be, you know, practical, using off-the-shelf parts. And I don't have any tools, so I can't cut anything to sizes, so I have to use whatever's available. And just assemble it, you know, it's like a craft, you know, like a school child craft project, because that's what level of efficiency I'm starting out at this point, because I have so little to work with. I have no equipment to test anything, you know, to get a readout, you know. I mean, I have something in storage, a frequency generator, but that's not, I don't think that's required in this, although I could be wrong. Maybe it's supposed to be fed a frequency, and if it is, it'll probably be a sine wave, I would imagine. But be that as it may, I really don't know what I'm getting myself in for. And will I electrocute myself, you know? Will it build? Well, it's, yeah, probably not. If I'm doing the one that's set in dielectric material, probably not. And I have it in a safe box. You know, Tesla used a wooden box for the Pierce Arrow demonstration, but I would obviously want to use... Well, no, see, if I use plastic... No, I have managed to electrocute myself against a plastic insulator because it was high voltage and my body was grounded out or near a grounding port on an electric wall outlet. So, yeah, I think wood would be desirable. Now that I think of it, I probably would not want to use plastic for the project case. Well, okay. Hey. Well, that's one thing the hardware store can do for you. And I remember you pay them to cut the wood to the size you wanted to use it, or to cut whatever you're using, PVC pipe. You know, they'll cut it for you. So, yeah, that's something I'd have to consider. In all likelihood, is probably use wood and get them to cut it. So there are solutions to this, how to do the first attempt. But I wasn't sure how I was going to do, since I'm working with leaf and it's going to be very small. The hinge I got was like 2-inch square, and it's got 4 screw holes in it, so it's not perfect, but it was cheap and small and magnetizable, and the leaf I'm getting is quite larger than that. I think it's 6 inches on the side. So anyway, it should be interesting. All these questions, and wonderments as to how to proceed, but at least I feel like it's something doable that I can get involved with. Because let's face it, electricity scares me. I played with fire when I was a kid. I was a little bit of a pyromaniac. Putting toothpicks in plastic cups and setting them on fire and melting the cup, creating a little mini bonfire. When everybody left, everybody went to work or school, and I was the last one because, you know, elementary school starts a little later than my big brother's school started, so I was left to play, and that's what I did to amuse myself. So anyway, you know, I'm a curious fellow, you know. I like, oh, what'll happen if I do this, you know? So, and I used to dream. I'll finish with this. When I was 4, I asked the question to myself, I wonder who will be my buddy, and we will build a UFO craft. That was my dream. You know, I didn't want to become a fireman or policeman. I wanted to build a UFO craft, and I dreamt about it at night, and I daydreamed about it by day. And if I had to take a guess estimate as to who my buddy is, I know who it is. It's probably more than one person. But it's something personal. I won't discuss it any further. Let's see what else. I think that's enough. That's a lot.